Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. South Korea severs military intelligence ties with Japan. In the latest escalation of a long-running and savagely bitter bilateral dispute that has already bounced from the historical space to the economic, Seoul took a cleaver today to a military intelligence sharing pact with Tokyo, shifting the damage into the military space. How have we gone from the historic to the economic to the military? For insight into this, we turn to my first guest. He has a PhD in political economy. He teaches economics and politics at St. Mary's College in California and is the author of the forthcoming book, The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Policy from Reagan to Trump. He is Dr. Jack Rasmus. As always, Jack, welcome back.
Thank you.
So the General Security of Military Information Agreement was up for renewal on this coming Saturday, but Seoul, in a move that had been widely signaled, announced today that it was terminating the agreement. The agreement was the brainchild of President Barack Obama's administration, which sought to promote greater defense cooperation between its two Northeast Asian allies. Both shared separate treaties with Washington, but no official ties between Seoul and Tokyo until this agreement went into effect in 2016. Tell us what's going on here.
Yes, well, you know, at one level, it's a reflection of growing disputes between countries here as the global economy slows down and as Trump uses sanctions to attack allies and opponents alike in order to get what he wants. Well, Japan is now playing the sanctions card. You see, this whole thing escalated when Japan, just several weeks ago, removed South Korea from special trading relationships and imposed restrictions on exports from Japan to South Korea. These are what we call rare earths and special chemicals that are necessary for the semiconductor industry. In other words, the big South Korean company, Samsung, was dependent on getting these exports on these chemicals from Japan. And Japan played the sanctions card now and is really a fight over market share in the semiconductor sector of the global economy. Semiconductors are in big trouble because of the trade wars. Mm-hmm. And they're declining. So Japan is hoarding these key chemicals and attacking Samsung, which is eating a lot of Japanese electronic companies' lunch in a number of fields. And Japan is now starting to hoard these key chemicals. Now, these chemicals are not only important for semiconductors, but for flat screen displays and so forth. They are of great military importance. And now, with the trade war, China, that controls most of the world's production of these rare earths and chemicals, right? It looks like China could start hoarding some of these chemicals and rare earths, as they're called, as part of the trade war. So Japan is starting to hoard these things and using it as a way of also going after Samsung. And it has to do with trade and trade war. And by the way, there's another backstory to this, and that is, why did Trump raise the idea of buying Greenland? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's kind of cuckoo, right? No, it's not, because Greenland is full of these rare earths.
Right.
And that's what Trump is looking at, because if the trade war gets worse, or worse than a trade war, economic war with China, then the U.S., not only South Korea and Japan, the U.S. may find itself without sufficient rare earths and chemicals to produce these military goods like flat screen displays, which is really invented by the military, you see. So it's military maneuvering going on. It's Japan using the sanctions card like the U.S. Other countries are beginning to do it, too. Trump has legitimized that. And it's a fight over the semiconductor industry and falling value in shipments of chips with the global economy slowing. It's really economic, and it's trade, and it's strategic, and it's military.
So just quickly going back to the Greenland issue, it's not what many people thought about it being above the ground and Donald Trump thinking he was going to build a resort and a golf course. It's what's below the ground in Greenland that was prompting Donald Trump to make that pitch. And you're tying that to what's happening between Seoul, Korea, and Japan. But why politics? Let's talk a little bit about they're seeming to put politics and economics before defense. From a defense perspective, with the defense capabilities that Japan has, both in terms of satellite technology and being able to spy on North Korea, as well as submariner technology with a submarine fleet, is Seoul really cutting off its nose to spite its face?
Well, yes, to some extent, it may be doing that, but you got to remember the whole thing originates with South Korea making demands on Japan to pay restitution for the comfort women from World War II. You know, that's how it really, really began. And then
Japan is saying to South Korea, we paid that, we settled that, next issue, please.
Yes. And then South Korea responded by saying, okay, individuals can sue Japanese companies. And then that precipitated Japan using trade sanctions, you know, the whole thing about removing South Korea from trading rights and trade restrictions on semiconductor chips and these chemicals and rare earths and so forth. But it may also reflect politically Japan maybe making some plans to boost its military capability. If it's going to do that, you know, Japan needs to control these key chemicals and rare earths that it needs if it's going to boost its military. That's maybe far-fetched, but, you know, I would not rule that out because Japan has been pushing to develop more independence in its military arms and military forces. And with growing instability throughout Asia, you know, it's unsure what the future may be, especially with Trump, you know.
But let's go back to North Korea and Kim Jong-un. And in less than a month, he's been firing short-range ballistic missiles that can hit both Japan and South Korea. So with Kim Jong-un engaged in those missile tests, I would just think that South Korea would be a little more skeptical of taking a move like this against Japan in terms of the defense agreement. And again, with Japan's capabilities in satellite reconnaissance, which is essential for viewing North Korea missile sites and test firing trajectories, unless, and this may be a far-fetched question, do you think that South Korea and North Korea are having friendlier conversations so that Moon Jae-in is more comfortable with Kim Jong-un than he was, say, a year ago?
Well, that could be one of the cards being played here. But, you know, I suspect that both South Korea and Japan expect the U.S. to come in and mediate this deal and come up with a solution. You know, I mean, they're not going to be able to do it themselves. And maybe, you know, that's all part of the maneuvering with Trump and the U.S. on trade and so forth. You know, there's a lot of connections here, but I suspect they're expecting the United States to come in and mediate this thing.
There's also a political element to this in terms of South Korea, because the public in South Korea, there's currently a very strong anti-Japanese mood on the ground in South Korea, which they're boycotting the purchase of Japanese products. They're boycotting travel. They're boycotting Japanese products. They're boycotting travel to Japan. There are protests in the streets where they're cutting up Japanese flags. So people in Seoul are not happy at all with Japan. And we know what, that we're about a year away from their National Assembly elections. So Moon Jae-in could very well be looking at his electoral prospects in the upcoming year.
Well, I'm sure, you know, local politics are part of it. But, you know, what you see here going on as well is this shift towards nationalism worldwide and national appeals, which is ultimately a product of the slowing global economy and Trump's trade wars. The U.S. Sets the tone and sets the example, and other countries say, well, you know, if Trump does it, why should we do it? You know, his appeal to crude nationalism in the United States seemed to work okay for him. Well, why don't we do that too? But, you know, if you turn to nationalism, what you got to do is turn towards identifying the other nation as enemy somewhere. And that's always the appeal of nationalism. You know, the outsider, the foreigner is the bogeyman. And, you know, Japan's the bogeyman for South Korea.
Xenophobia plays a huge, huge part in the nationalist perspective.
Absolutely. It's key. You can't have a right-wing nationalism without the enemy, who is always the outsider. I mean, look at the white nationalist movement in the U.S., you know. Oh, they're replacing us, you know, the replacement idea.
Yes.
They're all replacing us. You got to, I mean, look at the fascism, you know, in Germany. The Jew was the bogeyman. They weren't part of the German nation. They were outsiders who invaded us. So nationalism always has to have a foreign victim of some kind. And that occurs even with countries and nationalist appeals. And we see this resort to nationalist appeals as the global economy slows and economics begin to fade as a solution to keeping economies together. So I see part of this playing out there as well.
Dr. Jack Rasmus, as always, thanks for your time here on the Critical Hour. Greatly appreciate your contribution. Look forward to having you back.
Always.
Thanks, Jack. All right, folks, you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Ransomware attacks are testing resolve of cities across America. This has been the summer of crippling ransomware attacks. Wilmer, Texas, a town of almost 5,000 people just south of Dallas, is one of 22 cities across Texas that are simultaneously being held hostage for millions of dollars after a sophisticated hacker, perhaps a group of them, infiltrated their computer systems and encrypted their data. More than 40 municipalities have been the victims of cyber attacks this year, from cities such as Baltimore, Albany, and Laredo, Texas, to smaller towns, including Lake City, Florida. What's going on here? What's at stake? And is the national government taking appropriate action to defend the country? For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He's a web developer and technologist, Chris Garaffa. As always, Chris, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Oh, always great to be back on. Thanks for having me.
So first, let's start with a fundamental primer. Chris, what's going on here?
Well, what's going on here is that cities and towns and agencies across the country are getting hit with similar types of viruses that people at home get hit with. These particular ones are called ransomware, so they don't just turn your computer off. They actually lock up everything, they encrypt it, and they demand that you pay a certain amount of money, usually in a cryptocurrency like Bitcoin that can be harder to track, who the recipient is. They demand that you pay them a certain amount of money, and you hope then that after you do that, you've basically given in to the kidnappers. They're going to give you the special key to unlock everything on your computer. So this hits people at home often. You download something you shouldn't have off the internet, you open a suspicious email, but it's happening now in libraries and hospitals and government offices all across the country at an alarming rate.
Lake City is one of the few cities to have paid a ransom demand. They paid about $460,000 in Bitcoin, a cryptocurrency. One of the things I find interesting, if not at a minimum ironic, is that cyber thievery is now the ransom for cyber thievery is in a cryptocurrency.
Well, it makes sense. It's not impossible in general to track down a, who's receiving Bitcoin, but it can be made very, very difficult. Bitcoin isn't anonymous on its own, but it can be very difficult and close to impossible to track down who's receiving it. The problem I have with Lake City, Florida paying this is it says two things. It says to attackers, hey, you can go ahead and attack us and we're going to pay. But it also says to the rest of us that Lake City, Florida, along with many, many others, don't have appropriate backups of their data, which is really our data. So, for example, if New Haven, the city of New Haven were to lose all its tax records and had to pay, pay a ransom demand, this is where I'm living, not only am I paying as a taxpayer for that, it also shows me that New Haven isn't taking care of my data. And we're seeing this, again, all across the country. IT departments and administrative services are just not prepared. And this is not just a small city thing. This is happening up to cities the size of Baltimore as well.
Are these cyber bandits hitting what they consider to be low-hanging fruit? The majority seem to have targeted small-town America. To your point, larger cities, Atlanta, for example, has been hit. Baltimore has been hit. But a lot of these are small-town America. Are they figuring that sleepy, cash-strapped governments are the least likely to have updated their defenses and are then the most willing to pay?
That's what it seems to me. It doesn't seem to be let's cause the most, the most damage in many of these cases, right? You're looking at attacks on, libraries, which is awful, but it's not, shutting down schools, right? So in many of these cases, it is just about money. It's not a political thing. It's not, for any sort of political aim. But the response has certainly been political, and we have to talk about this. The way the FBI talks about this is that they say it's all overseas, and by the way, maybe a couple of Americans doing this, right? And it's playing into this idea that China, Russia, and Iran are just trying to hack, everything in the United States up to and including our elections. It's this whole nonsense that keeps going on and is just picking up again for 2020. Now, maybe some of these attacks do come from overseas, but there is no proof that I think any of them at this point are related to any government activity. The proof hasn't been out there, and we need to be aware of that when we're talking about these kind of attacks.
So I'm glad you brought up the election issue, because that to me is something that it's getting almost a passing reference. Of course, we've been hearing ad nauseum that the Russians hacked our system, which we know is bogus. But if in the 2020 election, if Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Florida, for example, get hit, that's 83 electoral votes. So help me understand, would it be harder to hack the electoral system in a state, or is that just an incredibly vulnerable target that isn't getting a lot of discussion?
Well, not to make the situation worse, but the answer is actually both. We don't have a standard for voting machines across the country. Each state, and in some situations, each county uses their own voting machines. They buy voting machines from third-party companies that have no transparency. So we have this move to digital voting machines that can be modified, that can be attacked both over the internet, but also no one ever talks about how easy it is to attack a voting machine in person. You walk up, you unscrew something on the side, and if you're in a booth, it's easy to do this because you can't be watched while you're voting. And you pop a card in with some specially crafted code, and you change that voting machine. And it's basically impossible to track unless you audit every machine, which we know is not in the budgets. So unfortunately, no, our voting system is not secure. As a technologist, I still advocate for paper ballots. Let's keep the technology out of this one.
Now, let me stay on the voting machine issue for a minute, because if I'm one of these cyber hackers and I'm not really interested in changing the outcome, I'm just interested in holding your election hostage until you pay me what I want, and then I'll release the data. I would think you would hack the central location where the data is processed.
Yeah, you would want to do that. You would want to install some malware onto voting machines, you know, en masse, and say, you know, after everything's been collected, we're not going to let the machine give you a total until you pay this.
Right.
I'm certainly not giving anyone ideas here. This has all been shown to be possible by security researchers.
Talk, if you would, about the history of this. A decade ago, the cyber crime was intellectual property theft, the stealing of designs and hacking into computers and stealing military secrets. Then you had the wormware, or whatever it was called, that hacked into Iran's nuclear centrifuges. But now ransomware is different, because it doesn't destroy the data or it doesn't destroy the equipment. It just locks it up. And as you said at the on the front end of the conversation, it locks it up until you pay for the key.
That's right. And these, you know, all three happen all, you know, generally at the same time, right? Like, they're not, you know, we haven't replaced the Stuxnet style, that virus
Stuxnet,
that was written by, you know, the U.S. government in Israel, supposedly, that attacked the Iranian nuclear reactors. We haven't gotten rid of that, right? Things like that still exist. But we now have this new weapon that's going around, this ransomware, which is, again, a lot less likely to be a state weapon, just because you still get the money. You know, you get the money and then you release the files. And it's smart for the ransomware manufacturers to actually release the files when you get the money, because otherwise no one's just going to trust them and they won't get any more money, right?
Right.
So there are different types of actors. You know, there are corporate actors, there are state actors, and there's, you know, individuals or small groups who are engaging in all of these different types of attacks.
So how do these attackers get into the network? Because, you know, companies and city employees, everybody's warned about, hey, don't answer or don't open that email that you don't know where it's coming from. We hear that ad nauseum. And you would think that the IT technicians or experts in these cities would be working on this 27 hours a day. So how do these attackers get into the network?
You know, you'd think that in an ideal world, we would have fully functional and staffed and supported and, you know, financed security systems keeping track of, you know, all of the information our cities and towns and states have on us. But that's often not the case. IT departments are very frequently underfunded in schools, in cities and states, and in governments. And unfortunately, you know, that's also slows things down. Bureaucracies can slow things down. So whether it's somebody opening an email that they shouldn't have opened that has a virus on it, that then gets, you know, the worm into the system from there, or it's a city not, you know, upgrading software to address a security issue that then the attackers take advantage of, there are so many ways that they can get in. But once they're in, it's hard to get them out.
I know you've given us, you're very gracious with your time today. I want to make these two points, and then if you don't have time to respond, I truly understand. One is, this has also created a tangential or business of cyber insurance, where companies now are paying insurance companies to protect them and pay out the ransom demand if, in fact, they are hit. As well as, this also now seems to be so lucrative that the cyber thieves are plowing their profits back into their research and development, which is keeping them on the cutting edge of all of this technology.
I'll just say this. It's the nature of the free market, isn't it? That the cyber insurance would come up before somebody starts making backups of the files they're about to lose.
Chris Garaffa, as always, Chris, thanks for your time. Greatly appreciate your contribution to the Critical Hour.
Thank you.
All right. All right, folks, you're tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Acting DHS Secretary McAleenan announces new rule on migrant family detention. The Trump administration is planning to hold migrant families in detention for the entire duration of their immigration proceedings, according to Acting Homeland Security Secretary Kevin McAleenan. He says the current standards incentivize illegal entry, which has caused and fueled the family crisis at our southern border. Here we go again. Almost every day, or at least every week, there's a new assault on immigrants, whether they be documented or whether they be undocumented or documented. For insight into the change announced yesterday, we turn to my next guest. He manages a solo practice dedicated exclusively to immigration law. He represents clients with complex family petitions, including VA, WA applications, and litigates before the Executive Office of Immigration Review. He is Mark Shmueli. Mark, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you, Wilmer.
We're also joined by pro-Palestine activist, peace and human rights leader, journalist, and author of Essays on Palestine, Robert Fantina. Robert, welcome back.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So the Supreme Court ruling known as the Flores Agreement currently limits the time families can be detained to 20 days. McAleenan says the new rule would allow families to be detained together for longer, and high standards will be implemented for the care of families in custody. Mark Shmueli, as a immigration attorney, your thoughts on this idea?
Well, it was just posted today. The rule, which is going to go into effect tomorrow, and so I was just pouring through the 591 pages of it, and I can tell you that the level of surreal information coming from this is kind of hit my shock level, and this is why. We know from all of the reporting out there, the common person knows right now the conditions for detention. We know that the administration has said we are overwhelmed. We cannot provide showers enough. We cannot provide soap enough. We cannot provide these basic necessities. And they've also talked about the trauma that it's caused the kids that are there. That's the reality we have. Even in the best light to the administration, they have called crisis. Yet when you read this, it reads as if you are in a place like North Dakota, where they've just built this huge resort or this huge facility where families can be, where there are big screen TVs, doctors at call, education, lots of programs all day that the parents can have a say in psychological therapy there all the time, 24/7 language interpretation, all of these things that are just not feasible. It's just not feasible with what we have. I mean, it would be like talking about the new rapid train system in Bangladesh that's going to go in tomorrow. It's just it's something that makes no sense, and it doesn't comport. And this is what's so scary. As I'm reading it, it's scary because this is how they're presenting it, and this is what's in the rule.
Robert
proposed.
Robert Fantina, to Mark's point, and according to McAleenan, detention facilities will be enhanced to become more like campuses, complete with three hot meals a day, recreational grounds, schools, and medical care. where's the money coming from? We can't even provide clean drinking water in Flint, Michigan, and in Newark, New Jersey. Where's the money coming from?
A very good question. And currently at the border, the government can't provide toothpaste and mattresses for children to sleep on. They can't provide enough soap. And now they're going to create all these wonderful facilities that will make it just like a country club along the border. Well, this is simply ridiculous. The point is that Trump wants to detain immigrants indefinitely, continue family separations. He said that one of the things he said about this was that conditions are so good that the in the United States that people want to come in. This will make it so they don't want to come here anymore. He's once again blaming the victim, which he often does. People are leaving war-torn and impoverished countries, often war-torn and impoverished because of U.S. policies, and they're trying to find a better life. He's trying to deprive them of that again. And here he's saying this, these wonderful facilities that are going to be built. Well, as he continues cutting taxes for the rich and depleting U.S. revenues, where this money is going to come from is just one of Trump's fantasies. He has no concept of cause and effect. He says whatever he wants to say, damn reality.
Robert, coming back to you, as a human rights leader and someone on the ground in the community, and Mark, I'll come back to you with this as well. Can you give me an idea of what's the daily impact that this is having on the psyche of people as every day there seems to be a different attack?
It's leaving people feeling very, very unsettled. People who've lived in this country for years don't know if they're going to be rounded up as just a few weeks ago on the first day of school. Hundreds and hundreds of parents were arrested when their children were dropped off from school. This, think of the impact on the children, seeing their parents arrested, and then where are they going to go? Where are they going to sleep that night? Who's going to pick them up? What's happened to their parents? Very unsettling, very troubling for the children. Parents, can you imagine being torn from your children and put into a cell somewhere and deported, not knowing where your children are? You drop them off to school like you've done every day for a few years, and it's unsettling, it's terrifying. There are many people who are now looking over their shoulders, not knowing if they're going to be able to safely drop their child off to school, not knowing if they're going to be able to safely go to work and come home, not knowing what's going to happen. And what's going to happen next? Is Trump going to come up with some other draconian measures to terrify them and as he puts it, deal with the immigration crisis, as if there was an immigration crisis? So it's a very unsettling, very difficult time for the parents, but especially so for children.
Mark, same question to you, and I'm coming to you more from based upon your legal practice. As Robert said, this is leaving people feeling very unsettled. Even people right. that are here legally, people that have come through the legal process, right. people with green cards, people that are here, talk about that, please.
No, I mean, I think that's true for all the reasons that Robert said it. And if you don't mind, I want to just, because I know we don't have a lot of time. I mean, Robert said exactly, I can't add anything to that. That's exactly what's happening in the community. And I think, you know, just, we talked a lot about like what can happen. I know this might be a later question. What can happen to this and what's wrong with this? Because it reads, what's scary is it reads so surreal. Because as Robert said, this is what's going on out there. This is what people are feeling. And they're saying we're providing, you know, when they say the active role in development of parenting, this reads as if it is a place for family development rather than a jail, as you read it. It reads that way. But they say that what's scary is that 2 months ago when the administration tried to stop any sort of bond for people seeking asylum and called for mandatory detention, the courts struck that down. And in this case, they're trying to do it again by calling for this mandatory detention. And the only way they can be released is through parole issued by the Department of Homeland Security. And they say that if you pass what's called their credible fear interview, then there's a chance you will have this parole, but they don't put any standard out and they don't explain it. And then they put these statistics, which I don't think are, I think they're doctored, of in absentia orders, people who don't show up in court as the majority, that this, the majority of people that are held in family units don't show up for court. If you're in that position of going to court, then you've passed your credible fear interview. So what they're saying is if you've passed credible fear, then we'll consider releasing you on parole. But we can't release you on parole because you've got it in absentia. So they're saying two things. And this is the problem, is that, again, it is a solution they have looking for a problem.
I was just going to say that all of the data that I have read and most of the stories that I have read indicate to me that the issue of people crossing the border, being detained, and not showing up for their hearing is less than 10%. And so all of this furor, all of this instability and unrest is a figment of Donald Trump's imagination. And his assistant, the guy that is accused of writing a lot of this stuff, whose name now escapes me.
Stephen Miller.
That this is really the diabolical machinations of Stephen Miller. And this stuff just isn't true. And Ken Cuccinelli from Virginia just isn't true.
Right.
You know, right. The problem is.
Go ahead, Robert.
The problem is that Donald Trump doesn't want non-whites in his country.
Right. Right.
We get down to that. There are people coming in. They are often poor because of the circumstances in their countries, again, often called the United States. And they are not of European descent for the most part. These are not the people that Donald Trump likes. These are people that he publicly dislikes. He has criticized them, insulted them, disdained them from before the campaign even began. So this is the problem that we're seeing, and this is why I think this is the key factor in his repressive immigration policies.
Now, Kevin McAleenan says the current standards incentivize illegal entry. Mark Shmueli, your thoughts on that statement?
Well, he's saying they incentivize illegal entry because they allow for people to be released and then they won't show up into court. And that's just not true. I mean, and also we're talking about people who are picked up at the border. They don't even enter. So you have that issue too, that these are people who, at this stage, very few people, that border is so fortified that very few people are being arrested once they've come in recently. They're getting caught at the border and they're applying for asylum. The problem is that they get a credible fear interview. And so far, they have not been able to have the credible fear interviews lead to the same denial rate as asylum cases lead to, which is very high. Once you pass the credible fear, then you're into the system and you could have a full hearing before a judge. The way this reads is if you don't pass a credible fear, then you have expedited removal. And if you have expedited removal, then all of this whole process doesn't matter because you're not going to be in a school. You're not going to be in a place like this big for long because you're going to be removed. And since Jeff Sessions, I mean, this has bothered him since day one of the administration is this idea that if you're going to be denied asylum later on, then you should be denied at the credible fear stage. The problem is the credible fear is a screening interview at the border by almost always unrepresented people. If they are represented, they're represented by phone, and the attorney has very, very little role, and they have certainly no time to prepare. And it's an interview right there, and by an asylum officer who goes down to the border to do this. And if they have an inkling, if they think that there's a possibility that there's a claim there, then they let a judge hear the full claim. I think personally the credible fear process violates international human rights law because you're denying people who can't have a claim at any level, even if it's a 2%, but it's still a low percent, but he wanted it, and the administration wants it up to 60%, 70% of denial right there.
But wasn't the law, if I get to the border and I say, I'm seeking asylum in America, isn't that all I'm supposed to have to say for the process to begin, for it to be determined whether or not my claim is legitimate or not?
Well, they do what's called a credible fear interview. And up to now, it's a screening so that you don't have, you know, so that you're not somebody from, you know, Germany claiming to be, you know, persecuted because you're Christian.
Right.
So where it's something that there is no real basis for. So if you have something colorable, then you're going to go to a court and then you can present your evidence. And because in a credible fear interview, it's literally that. It's like a straight interview with you.
I understand. But what I'm saying is, and I know I'm being very simplistic in my example, but if I get to the border and I say I'm seeking what I'm trying to draw is the distinction between seeking asylum and an economic refugee. That's what I'm.
Oh yeah, right, right. If you're saying you're asylum, they have to allow you into that process, and then you are not, and then you have the you have the ability to show that. I mean, part of what the administration's doing, I think for exactly the reasons that Robert was saying before, is who Donald Trump wants in the United States is.
Got you.
They don't care. Like they don't care about this international human rights stuff, and they wouldn't have when it was Jews at the time, or you know when it was lighter skinned people either. They don't want people. Their basic thing is that's your problem, your country. I mean,
if I'm from Norway, I'm okay.
Yeah, okay. It really is overturning all these years.
Let me do this. Let me give Robert just about 45 seconds because I got to get out. Final thoughts, Robert, as we wrap this up.
As the charge that these current policies incentivize people to come into the United States is ridiculous. People fleeing their countries know what conditions are like, know how hard it is to get across the border. Think how desperate they must be in order to try to come to the United States. Think how awful situations must be. They have to leave their homes, their extended family members, friends, employment, all they have because things are so bad and they're coming to a country that they know doesn't want them and yet they're still trying to get in. So this is a level of desperation that anyone with any compassion would have a tremendous amount of sympathy for. But then again, we're talking about Donald Trump.
Robert Fantina and Mark Shmueli. Gentlemen, thank you both for your time today. Greatly appreciate it. I know I'm having y'all back because it's only going to get worse before it gets better.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. All right. All right, folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're tuned to Radio Sputnik here, The Critical Hour. No pay, we stay. Protesting miners in Harlan County, Kentucky are not going anywhere. People and organizations continue to stop by a railroad track in Cumberland, bringing food and water to protesting miners. The miners have prevented a train hauling coal from the Cloverlick No. 3 mine for more than 24 hours. One group among the endless stream of supporters came from John Evan Jacks in Corbin, Kentucky. They rolled their mobile kitchen to Harlan to feed the miners free of charge. What's going on here? Well, for insight, we turn to my next guest. He is the owner of the mobile kitchen called John Evan Jacks. He is Nathan Brown. Mr. Brown, welcome to the Critical Hour.
Thank you.
So explain to us what's going on here in Kentucky.
Well, what had happened was these miners had gotten their last paycheck, and then from my understanding, those paychecks bounced. So some of them had cashed their checks. I mean, it's affected a whole community there.
About how big of a community is it?
There's quite a few. Now, the number affected is, I think the rough number was about 113 at that mine. There was about, my understanding, there's about 113 of them laid off. So
is it that now the miners whose checks have bounced have decided that if you're not paying us for the coal that we dug, we're not going to allow the train carrying the coal to get to be processed and go to market?
Yes, that is what they're doing.
And so talk about what got you involved. Tell us about John Evan Jacks and how you decided to get involved and support these miners.
Well, we actually do a lot of stuff for our communities, and we try to reach outside of our communities as much as we can. And, I've got a lot of family in Harlan County and Cumberland area. So, that when I saw that, I just decided, hey, we're going to load up. And I called a couple of my employees the night before we went up there, and they said they were willing to go. So we loaded up and took off, and we fed them that next day. And they liked it so good, they asked us back on. We went on a Tuesday, and they went back on a Sunday also. So we fed them. They done church on the train tracks there. They actually had church on the train tracks. So we fed them some good old country cooking, some chicken and dumplings, corn, green beans, and mashed potatoes. So they appreciated that. But they're really struggling right now. It's affected more than just that the miners, the miners had a little grocery store there that they cashed their paychecks at, and they cashed those checks, and some of them got their money, and then those checks bounced on that grocery store. So I think it affected them. I think they cashed $91,000 worth of checks, is my understanding.
Is this a small part of a bigger problem as it relates to coal in the country?
I think it could be. I don't know what the real problem is there, why they wasn't able to get the coal out to get these miners paid before now. But I mean, it seems like there could be a bigger problem, and there's the loopholes are for the coal mines. I just saw on the news now that the Harlan County School is going to have to pay back, don't quote me on this, but I'm pretty sure it's about $75,000 in property tax they're going to have to pay back to the mines. So that was another loophole that the lawyers found for them. So it's just, there's something new developing every day. And those guys have been there close to 3 weeks now, maybe a little bit more than 3 weeks.
Your family, has been involved in mining for generations, correct?
Oh yeah. My family have mined there for as far back as I can remember. I'm almost 40 years old, and I've had family there mining the whole time. So,
and give us an idea. I'm thinking now about when presidential candidate Hillary Clinton talked about putting an end to mining. President Trump came in saying no, that with clean coal, and he was going to revitalize mining. Has that revitalization been realized in Cumberland County, Kentucky?
I really hadn't been involved with it until this. So, I can see that it was putting food on a lot of people's table.
Mm-hmm.
So, it was, Trump definitely helped bring it back. But, now we just need to find ways to keep it prosperous. Because right now doesn't look like it's very prosperous for the people that's actually digging the coal.
As I understand it also, not only is this a dispute between the miners and the mine, but because we're talking about trains and railway, CSX, who owns the railway, is also involved. And so far, it seems they're saying that they're monitoring the situation. They understand that it's related to a dispute between the mining company and its workers, and that they're trying to be sure that their employees are safe, but they also at the same time seem to be kind of staying out of the situation.
Oh yeah, CSX definitely done the right thing. They stepped up and they went up and met with the miners actually and said, hey, we've got some train operators back there that really need to get home to their families, and asked them if they could just get the engines out of there. And those miners, they're being the great guys that they are. They just, you can take the take the engines out, but we're not letting any coal come out. So I thought that was really cool on the miners' part that they done that. They're not just doing it for attention. They're doing it for a reason. So I thought it was really good.
Now, as I understand it, this is the Black Jewel Mine, and they filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy the 1st of July. So this mine has been struggling for a little while. So talk about a little bit about what was happening in July or what was happening in June as the mine was recognizing its problems, filing for bankruptcy, and now checks are bouncing.
You know, actually, I don't know, other than what I've seen on the news about it, I really don't know anything about that part of it. I don't know what led up to filing bankruptcy and all that stuff. But, you know, obviously they had the coal to get out because they're trying to get it out now. But I don't know.
Okay. How long do you think you're going to continue to feed these unpaid miners?
Well, we've kind of stepped out of the way now. You know, us stepping up and doing that, other food trucks have showed up and all that stuff. But my cousin, I'm not going to mention her name or her son's name, he works for those mines. And I stay in close contact with them. And if they need anything, they know all they got to do is give me a call and we'll be right there. So I thought that was really cool. So,
in fact, I see a picture in the paper of them doing that. I guess now that the engine is gone, they don't have to worry about a train coming through because that cornhole board is right in the middle of the train track.
Yeah. Well, now they have tents set up. They've got tents, tables, chairs, all that stuff. So,
okay.
So they're there to stay. They're staying until they get paid. So
Nathan,
and I just talked to my cousin day before yesterday, and he said that he didn't feel like they were any closer to getting paid. So that's all I know.
Okay, one more question, because now that the mine has filed for bankruptcy, if they are able to get the current checks cleared, what happens with the workers going forward? Is the mine closed? Are they going to go back in? And go ahead.
Well, my understanding is, if they've sold that mine, somebody has bought that mine, and they've had donations, that mine, the new owners, has set up a fund, and they're trying to help pay all that back and all that stuff. But
I see.
I just don't think things are happening quick enough for them.
Gotcha. Okay. That was my final question. Nathan Brown from John Evan Jacks in Corbin, Kentucky. Thank you so much for your time, and keep feeding those folks as long as they need to eat.
We'll do that.
Appreciate it. All right, folks, you are listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. We're back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. The ACLU in Baltimore calls surveillance plane over Baltimore a privacy nightmare. They said yesterday that a surveillance plane, reinstituting the surveillance plane, would be a privacy nightmare come to life. It's the equivalent of requiring residents to wear a GPS tracker whenever they leave their homes. What's going on here? Well, for insight, we turn to my next guest. He's an activist. He's the co-host, along with Sean Blackman, of By Any Means Necessary. He's also a resident of Baltimore. He is Eugene Puryear. Eugene, welcome back to The Critical Hour.
Well, Dr. Leon, thank you so much for having me.
So when you stepped out of your home this morning onto the street, was there a surveillance plane hovering over you?
You know, it may have been, and that's actually very scary to even think about. I've been following this for a couple of years when it first came out, and the technology, I wasn't even living in Baltimore then, but just the implications of this are unbelievable. One of the people who's one of the funders of this, by the way, is a guy named John Arnold, who used to be an Enron trader, so that gives you some sense of the efficacy of something like that. But, I mean, I think I agree 100% with the ACLU. I think this is a dangerous escalation. And it's interesting to see the shifting sands of this plane. So when they first brought it in, and worth noting here that this is based on technology from the Iraq War, but when they first brought it in, they said, well, it's about crime. We're going to stop crime by doing all this. Then it was heavily criticized. Then, you know, the Baltimore police become heavily criticized. And they changed it, and they said, well, you know what this is also good for? We can track all the police officers, so we'll be able to see police brutality. So, yeah, you know, this is actually great for everyone because we're going to hold the police accountable with this surveillance technology. So that in and of itself, I think, gives you a window into how ridiculous it is.
I think car tracking technology along with body cam footage would be enough to cover the police aspect. You know, one of the things that jumped out at me when, as I have been following this for a while as well, is that John and his wife, Laura, they, as private sector individuals, they are providing a 3-year grant, the cost estimated to be $2 million a year for 3 years. It's horrific no matter who pays for it. Right. But I think with neoliberal policies and this whole privatization of our government, this private aspect of this is frightening to me as well.
You know, I think it's deeply frightening, and I think it's part of a scary trend that flies under the radar. For instance, you know, many people criticized, in fact, the AP won a Pulitzer for it, I believe, the NYPD usage, working with the CIA and surveilling people in terrorism. That was actually paid for by grants mainly from Wall Street bankers and the New York Police Foundation. So we're starting to see DC also has a police foundation. Many of these large city police departments start to rely on these law and order, pro-police, right-leaning billionaires, oftentimes 100 millionaires, to fund things that they probably wouldn't be able to fund if it had to go through an appropriations process. And, you know, on top of all of that, it's worth noting, persistent surveillance did not actually end suicide bombings in Baghdad or anywhere else where they used it. So there isn't even really a lot of evidence to show that this can even work. But you have people like Arnold who are saying, well, I believe in the technology. And so you've got another sort of set of law and order policies where people say they believe those policies are going to make a big deal, but there's no evidence to do it. But we certainly can see the evidence of the negativity it causes for people who become trapped in these surveillance dragnets.
What do you say to those who say, well, we have cameras now on every corner, especially when you go to New York City? If you go to London, you're always under closed circuit camera surveillance. And there, well, what did you say to those who would say, well, this is just the next logical step between CCTV?
Well, I would say that's part of the problem. I mean, of all the studies I've ever seen about CCTV in London, the notable thing is it hasn't really worked at all to stop crime. I mean, you've got this epidemic of knife crime happening in London. You've got cameras every single place. The most places I see the CCTV work is after a protest when they go back and get some kid, some 14-year-old kid, for breaking a window 6 months after the protest. But what we know is that's part of the problem. We have this proliferation of cameras, this proliferation of a panopticon society. But when we study it, we aren't seeing any concomitant gains in terms of any way, whether it be crime, whether it be quality of life, whatever it may be, we're not seeing those gains actually being made. And so I'd say, let's not add one more, even more persistent camera when we know that the ones we have already aren't actually doing what people want, which is to help keep people safe.
And the rules are pretty simple. We don't like the people we're shooting at.
Exactly. I mean, you look at this situation like what we saw in Philadelphia with the guy holed up shooting there. We know in 84 they dropped the MOVE bomb. I mean, is it that crazy to think that they could have used a drone to, like, launch a missile at that house and blow the thing up? You know, I don't really think so. And I think sometimes we don't realize how paper thin the wall really is between what we have now and what we fear.
And that's really the point here. And it's also, I think, important for people to understand that moves like this aren't usually large. Mm. They're incremental. Mm. And so you start with drones in Iran,
right,
or Iraq, or Somalia,
mm-hmm,
and pretty soon you have drones in San Francisco,
right,
and or Oakland, and then the drone has a missile on it.
Mm-hmm.
And is it going to be a Hellfire missile? Probably not.
Right.
But it'll be some type of explosive device,
mm-hmm,
and folks, that's not going to work well for anybody. Eugene Perrier, hey man, as always, tell folks where they can hear by any means necessary and when.
Right here on Radio Sputnik, between 2 to 4 every day, Monday through Friday, we are here with By Any Means Necessary. And the pleasure's all mine. Always happy to be on the Critical Hour.
Man, thank you, and your show's fantastic. I listen to it all the time, and every now and then I am blessed to be a guest on it.
Indeed.
Thank you, man. All right, folks, you've been listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened, and I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.